So glad to welcome to the program this morning, American Enterprise Institute's James Pethakoukas. James, always appreciate when you take the time to join us here for a few minutes. I have a wonderful sound bite that I wanted to read to you. It comes from Shama Sawant. She is a socialist member, by the way, an avowedly socialist member of the Seattle City Council. She is pushing a $15 minimum wage, 50% higher than what they're trying to push in Washington, D.C. And she was asking about, well, youth unemployment's very high, and you oppose a training wage for young people. And she says, that's because high unemployment among youth is caused by a lack of jobs, not by the minimum wage. I thought I'd give you that nice slow pitch across the middle to start the conversation with.
Yeah, I think the sort of intellectual leap, and thanks for having me on, that she's not making is that there may be a link between government forcing businesses to pay a government-determined wage and jobs. That's the leap she's not making. And I think the research is fairly clear that if we crank up the minimum wage, certainly to the levels that we're talking about, you're going to get less job growth. There are going to be fewer jobs for young people. There'll be fewer low-skill jobs. And listen, it's great for people who have a job. That's fine. Maybe they'll make more, assuming they don't lose their job. But what it's really good ultimately is for machines. That's great if you want there to be more machines. If you want there to be more machines in your McDonald's, then this is a great way to do it. But if you want to create more jobs, cranking up the minimum wage won't do it and will, frankly, lose jobs.
So I guess you can say, if you're a supporter of the $15 an hour minimum wage, that you're actually working to create jobs in the service automation industry.
Yeah, there'll be some jobs created. People may be making those machines until the robots make those machines. Right. Absolutely. That's where your job growth might happen.
All right.
Let me just say that. It's kind of strange that if we think that if we're not producing the kinds of workers that are able to earn a higher wage, and that to me is a countrywide education system wide problem, that we would want that problem fixed by McDonald's.
I appreciate you taking the time to be here. Something else I thought you would love is, as you know, most fast food outlets you go to are not run by corporate central. They're franchises, right? But they are identified in Seattle as big businesses. And so they would be subject to having to pay the $15 an hour minimum wage immediately if this ballot measure actually qualifies for the ballot and is passed, because they're not small businesses, they're big businesses. So, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say that the more of those folks talk, and especially when you keep in mind not just the job loss probability from minimum wage, but the fact that it's really a very poorly – if what you want to do is help low-skill workers, full-time workers, it's a very poorly targeted measure, that what you really tend to get from these people is they really just don't like business very much. They certainly don't like what they would call big business, but – and they want to take a chunk out of their hide. Oh, if it helps some people, well, that's fine too. But if you actually think about solving problems, then you would be taking different approaches.
While we're talking about solving problems, American Enterprise Institute is outlining 22 ways to get the economy moving and specifically help the middle class. What do you think the top three ideas to help the middle class are right now, James?
Well, and let me say it, it's there's a lot of AI folks involved. It's not just
right.
AI.
Number of scholars.
People. Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. That's right. Listen, we have the top three ideas. Listen, we have a big health reform plan. That's part of it. We were just talking about the jobs issue, and some of the ideas are actually lowering the minimum wage for long-term unemployed people, and then making up any loss of pay with a wage subsidy. Largely expanding the child tax credit for middle class working class families, which we think has a number of benefits, makes it easier to finance a college education for those kids, do all kinds of things. It's good for economic growth. And my particular part of the contribution looks at deregulation to create a lot more business startups, which are really key to having a dynamic economy. And I think that's really one reason why we have not had a dynamic economy, not just the past 5 or 6 years, but over the course of the 2000s.
Are you pessimistic or optimistic about economic growth here, the economy growing in the next 6 to 12 months, James?
I'm pretty optimistic for the rest of this year that we might get some of the best growth that we've had since before the Great Recession. But that's 6 or 9 months. At some point, we should have a bit of a snapback where we have better than average growth. But whether it's folks on Wall Street or in Washington, business people, when you look over the longer term, not the very long term, but 3 to 5 to 10 years, they just don't see this economy growing as quickly as it has in the past, which is where you get all this talk about a new normal. I think they're right. I think you're going to have a less dynamic economy, economy that's overtaxed, overregulated, and you're going to get slower economic growth going forward. So listen, we had a down quarter in the first quarter, economy dropped by 1%. Might get a bounce back in the second quarter, maybe for the rest of this year. But, longer term, I'm pretty pessimistic about our long-term growth in America and therefore the kinds of good jobs we can create without some substantial changes, some of which we outline in the book.
Now, when people say, hey, wait a minute, this doesn't make sense. The stock market is peaking. The stock market has grown explosively, and yet the economy's not growing. What's happening here?
Well, one, we have the economy, you have the stock market bouncing back from the Great Recession. Two, you've had very easy money from the Federal Reserve, and one of the points that the Fed was trying to do was boost the stock market. Then hopefully that would create a wealth effect and more economic growth. So you have the Fed, plus a lot of those profits do come from overseas as well, not just Europe, but also China, Japan. So the stock market isn't a perfect proxy for the U.S. economy, and you have it inflated by the Fed. So if you're just going to point to the stock market, I think you're really missing what's really going on in the economy when you look at continued high unemployment, so-so job growth, and wages going nowhere.
And the other thing that's interesting is that when you try and erase income inequality by hitting the rich with higher taxes, you get what happened in Great Britain, which I believe 3 years ago they raised their top rate 20%. And they got back less revenue the year after. In France, they've just announced that they've received, after raising the income tax, the value-added tax, and the corporation tax under President Hollande 2 years ago, they have received $16 billion euros less than they had forecast to receive. So they've got a hole to fill. And, of course, they say, well, I guess we were overly optimistic about projections.
I think if your goal is to help people climb the ladder, help the middle class, I'm not sure what raising taxes on a small slice of the American public is going to accomplish other than getting less revenue. Now, if you're approaching it from some sort of moral point where you think it's just immoral that they're not paying a higher tax rate, fine, you can make that case. But don't think you're helping anybody, because you're not.
Let me recast the question in a completely different direction. Again, my guest, James Pethakoukas, American Enterprise Institute. There is a new book, an anthology, Room to Grow: Conservative Reforms for Limited Government and a Thriving Middle Class. They come up with 22 specific reforms.
Free book. Free and
oh, yeah, free. Yeah, I forgot to point that out. That
I
is a free
to
book.
Being free. I'm a capitalist. Yes. I was overruled.
Yeah, no, there's no such thing as a free lunch. There is such thing as a free book.
Yeah.
You can download the book at AEI.org. James, there's a congressman, David Jolly, out of Florida, who the guy who was just elected in the special election a few months ago. He has come up with an idea. He says an alternative maximum tax, that no American should pay more than half of his or her income in total taxation, state, federal, and local combined. What do you, as an economist, think about a policy like that?
Listen, to me, that, and I was just talking about making a moral case. To me, there is a moral case to be made that when you earn a dollar, that you should not have to pay more than half of that dollar to the government. I think that's a moral case you can make. I think economic case really depends on how we're how we're being taxed, what's being taxed. I certainly don't think at this point. You mentioned the great example from what you saw in England about raising the top tax rate, to 50% and losing money. I think that is sort of the peak of where the Laffer curve, the old Laffer curve, where you start losing money.
Right.
And listen, there's a lot of folks on the left. They want to take tax rates up to 70%, 80%. They talk about the 1950s when they were at 90%. Those are the kind of rates they're talking about. I don't know if you've talked about this. French economist Thomas Piketty has his big bestseller out. He wants 80% tax rates on income, 80% global taxes on wealth. That's the kind of tax code they're talking about. So when you talk about limiting it to 50%, well, that's way below what they want.
Well, in France, the income threshold for the wealthiest citizens was raised right in that neighborhood, James, 75% last year.
Yeah. When you
and unemployment,
I feel very confident that those kind of tax rates over the long term are terrible for economic growth. And if you're supporting those kinds of tax rates, you're just doing it for an economic reason, for some other reason, and you should be upfront about that.
Let me reinforce what you just said. The unemployment rate at the end of 2013 in France was 11%. And I'm guessing it might even be higher than that, for the same reason that our unemployment rate is really higher than it is, because so many people dropped out of the workforce during the recession and are no longer counted as unemployed. But their unemployment rate is at a record high of 11%. Their economy saw zero growth in the first 3 months of this year. They had 0.2 growth 3 months previous. That is what they have more than a year after they, quote, soaked the rich with income tax, value-added tax, and corporation tax increases that now raise the tax threshold to 75% on their wealthiest citizens.
Europe as a whole, unemployment's 11, over 11%. They've had a double dip recession. Some people are worried about a triple dip recession. And with that kind of environment, to think that here's what we need: we need to crank up taxes even higher. Again, you're not helping anybody. What you're doing is satisfying some sort of, ideological problem with how much money businesses make. The political situation in France, they're wildly unhappy with this government. They just had a huge vote for right of center candidates.
Right.
And I think maybe even France is finally waking up that, lots of regulation, very high taxes is not the way to boost growth and create jobs.
And I know this isn't your degree of focus and expertise, but aren't there countries in Europe, greater Europe, that have low unemployment? And
the British economy is actually finally bouncing back, and is frankly doing much better than most of the European countries, other than Germany. They've begun to actually finally even to cut taxes in Italy.
Yes, and they're seeing again. They're doing this because they've seen the same revolt at the ballot box. It's very interesting what's going on in Europe right now.
It is, and people love talking about inequality. They love talking about it on the left. But at some point, here's what people really care about. They care about, are they doing better this year than last year? Do they think they're going to do better in the future? Do they think their children are going to do better? And they're not quite seeing why this, you know, why this strange war on inequality against the 1% or the point, you know, the 0.1%. They don't really see how that's helping them, which is a pretty good conclusion because it's not.
Right. And it is ultimately the war against inequality as it's being waged by the political left is really a war on freedom.
It's a war on the free enterprise system and on economic freedom, which, you know, that's not how they view the world. They view the world from a very top-down, that, you know, growth is created by government, that the whole economy is just one big government program, and you should be lucky to keep whatever you do keep.
James Pethakoukas, American Enterprise Institute, the book, the free book, Room to Grow, 22 Conservative Reforms for Limited Government and a Thriving Middle Class. Hey, thanks ever so much for joining us again here on The Commute with Carlson in Seattle on Talk Radio 570 KVI, James.
Love doing it. Thanks for having me on.
You got it. It is 21 minutes after 7 o'clock. Good morning.